wanted to talk today about Zen and freedom. So a few years ago, I read a quote somewhere, and I couldn't find it again, but it was something like that the practice of Zen is not about happiness, but about freedom. And I remember really liking that idea at the time. And so when I talk about freedom today, I'm talking in the context of our Zen practice. And as Buddhist practitioners, there are roughly 40 million people in the world who are living in conditions of modern slavery and many other oppressed people. So obviously what freedom means to them is something completely different. So I don't pretend to speak for them. Yeah. It's got some very noisy wind chimes here. So, but when we look at the Four Noble Truths, basically they are about liberation from dukkha, so from the causes of dukkha. And the causes of dukkha or suffering or the unsatisfactory nature of existence are greed, hatred, and ignorance. And then the fourth noble truth is that there is a path of liberation from these and a sense of freedom from living with dukkha. So I've been thinking about how much freedom do we actually have. And when we talk about freedom, it's something that we tend to value very highly. It's almost like a visceral response we have to that sense of wanting to be free and living with freedom. And of course, the pandemic has changed some of that for us. You know, what we took for granted are some of our freedoms, like freedom of travel or association, things like that. We put on hold for a while. And as we know, some people have found that very difficult and are still finding it very difficult. But when we think about it, we don't actually have all that much freedom just in our day-to-day life. So for instance, we all drove here in a car. And so in order to do that, we had to have a vehicle that's registered and roadworthy. We had to have a license and, you know, pass certain tests and have to maintain the license. So there's a lot of obligations there. And then to drive here, we had to follow many different road rules. And if we keep ignoring them, of course, eventually we lose our license. So that's just a very small example. I remember when seatbelts were introduced, or actually I don't remember, I was too young, but I remember reading when seatbelts were first made mandatory, some people actually bought t-shirts with a seatbelt print to pretend that they were wearing a seatbelt because they found it such an intrusion on their sense of freedom to be asked to wear a seatbelt. And now we just put seatbelts on this. I haven't seen many people walk around with those t-shirts. So basically, to live in a society, we do have some freedoms and some lack of freedom. When we bring it to Zen practice, I guess there's a clear sense of having freedom to make choices. So one very famous quote is by Viktor Frankl, that idea of having the freedom to choose how we respond to situations, even in the midst of a concentration camp, that we still have the ability, that freedom to choose our response. And Thich Nhat Hanh also has a quote that at any moment we have a choice that leads us either closer to a spirit or further away from it. So that sense of having the agency and making choices about how we respond. There are actually quite a number of factors that impact our ability to make choices. And so one of the areas that I've worked in quite a bit over the years is the area of acquired brain injury. So when people have a significant injury to their brain, and that's a long-lasting impact. And when people have a brain injury, what often happens is that the frontal lobe is affected, especially with things like car accidents. And the frontal lobe is very crucial for decision-making, impulse control, having empathy for other people, our sense of morality. And when that part is affected, it really impacts their ability to make good choices and decisions. And so people who, you know, in the past might have been really conscientious people and very considerate of others suddenly start acting in a way that's really to the family out of character, very inappropriately, for instance, towards young girls, or to, you know, get abusive all the time. And sometimes that can happen in aged care as well, that the frontal lobe starts to deteriorate and grandpa or grandma comes up with all kinds of things that the family finds deeply shocking. So, you know, in order to make decisions, we need a brain that's functioning well. And of course, it's not just a brain injury that impacts, it's also stress. So ongoing stress has been shown to decrease the activity of the prefrontal cortex. And so that's when we are under stress, we often say and do things that we later regret. But even the food we eat can impact the way our brain functions, the air that we breathe. There's quite a strong link between the health of our gut and mental health. So for instance, if someone is born by cesarean, cesarean birth, they actually have different bacteria in their guts, which may not be quite as healthy as someone who's born through vaginal birth and things like that. There's also evidence that ongoing childhood trauma or neglect can impact the development of the brain. And so children growing up in that environment often have, you know, a heightened sense of being triggered, like the amygdala is very hyperactive, but the ability to control is diminished. So there are many different ways that we are impacted. And psychology is full of experiments where people are tricked. So, for instance, you know, they're told, we're coming here and this is what we're studying, but in the waiting room, someone is rude to them. And then they measure whether that makes people more generous or less generous. And there's quite a strong link between an unpleasant experience like that and becoming less generous. Another experiment that's been done many times is if there's any sort of hint of reminder of our mortality. So just the word, some words to do with death, not even talking about death, but a very small trigger makes us more prejudiced against people who are not like us and things like that. And of course, advertising is very clever at influencing that for us as our politicians. But leaders of any kind can be very good at manipulating us into acting in ways that maybe we hadn't particularly intended, or we don't even realize why we're acting in a particular way, but because someone's deliberately triggered us to act in certain ways. And I'm sure we all believe that we're the one person in the world who's not impacted by advertising, or, you know, I'm like, oh, that's not going to affect me. But I think the reality is that we are constantly being impacted by other people sort of trying to manipulate how we vote and what we buy and even what religion we follow or how we follow people. So there's also that sense of having our individual responsibility versus what's called the social model of health. So we often believe that, you know, we are in charge of our health and well-being, and the way we act impacts on that. But there's a lot of evidence to show that environmental factors and social, cultural and political factors can make a huge impact on people's outcome, health outcomes. So for instance, if you live in an area where there's lots of parklands, people tend to be healthier. There's a strong link between housing stress and insecure housing and poor health outcomes and things like that. And there's also the other element of how we project things onto others. So Carl Jung wrote a lot about that, that we all have aspects in our psyche that we'd rather not acknowledge. So what he called the shadow side. And so if you don't want to acknowledge that, we have to project it onto someone else. And that could be someone in the family, like the black sheep of the family. It could be a particular cultural group, you know, those people, they're the ones who are causing all the trouble, things like that. But we can also project some of our better qualities onto others. So for instance, we can project onto religious leaders and can say, you know, they're such an amazing person and they have to carry all the higher aspects of us for us as well. And there's a lot of examples of religious leaders probably starting off with good intentions, and then they get all that projection from their followers, and they become often very self-centered and sometimes then quite abusive because they're trying to live with all that projected onto them and not managing it very well. And I had a really example of that when I did one of my early music therapy placements in a nursing home, and one of the women residents came up to me and started getting really angry at me and abusing me. And I was like, oh, I don't know what's going on. What did I do? And then she started calling me a different name. And I thought, oh, she's talking to, you know, her niece or someone, her daughter. Like, I was just standing there. So that's a sort of obvious example. But I think on a more subtle level, that actually happens quite a bit. So you maybe something happened at work and you can't get upset at your boss. So then you drive home, you have road rage, or you let it out on your partner, children, things like that. So there's a lot of times when we're actually unconsciously projecting using things like scapegoating. And also, for instance, women can be seen sometimes as, you know, they're either saintly and, you know, amazing mothers, or they're like a whore and, you know, loose morals and things like all those sort of projections we can have, which has very little to do with the reality of what's going on. And in Buddhism, we talk about the five skandhas. It's just the five ways we perceive reality, and that they're actually all flawed in one way or another. So that brings us to the practice of Zen. And one of the interesting things about Zen is that when we practice, we actually deliberately put ourselves into situations of less freedom. So even the way things are structured here today, you know, there's a certain, the way we have the rituals and the way we move and sit and things like that. And of course, when we have a retreat, a session, we're actually really letting a lot of freedom go. And we're just doing everything as per schedule and what we're supposed to do. And that lack of freedom can actually help us to deepen the practice of becoming more free, which is kind of perhaps a bit of a paradox. So I've got a quote here by a Buddhist teacher called Ten McLeod. And he says, "What is freedom? It is a moment-by-moment experience of not being run by one's own reactive mechanisms. Does that give you more choice? Usually not. When you are not run by reactions, you see things more clearly. And there's usually only one, possibly two causes of actions that are actually viable. Freedom from the tyranny of reaction leads to a way of experiencing life that leaves you with little else to do but take the direction that life offers you in each moment. Hence, the illusion of choice is an indication of a lack of freedom." And so we have the two extremes. So one is individualism, where we think, you know, we're in complete control of our lives, and everything we do is down to us, and we have complete freedom of action. And then versus determinism, which says all events are determined by previously existing causes and conditions. And of course, the Buddhist concept of karma comes into that as well. And like most things in Buddhism, we sort of live in the middle way between complete individualism and complete determinism. So we understand that we are interconnected and that we are here as a result of causes and conditions. But we're also doing a practice because we do believe that we do have a sense of agency and that we can make some choices. And so I'll just finish with a quote by Thich Nhat Hanh. "Letting go gives us freedom, and freedom is the only condition for happiness. If in our heart we still cling to anything, anger, anxiety, or possessions, we cannot be free."